I'm Kim Hill, chairing a panel discussion today about climate change. If there's one thing that can be described as borderless and global, apart from COVID-19, of course, it's climate change. It will affect all of us on the planet, no matter whether we're major or minor contributors to it. Just existing means we're contributing to it, right? Policy on how to deal with climate change varies enormously, and it's become a political issue, just like COVID, with the argument between the laissez-faire right and the state interventionist left. The vital thing in these kind of polarized debates, it seems to me, is reliable information, which has the ability to carve out some common ground, which brings us to an initiative that our speakers today are involved in. It's called the Global Environmental Measurement and Monitoring Network, or GEM for short. GEM was launched in 2018 to measure and predict local impacts of climate change. Early nodes of the network have been established in California. Welcome to Dr. Tom Beyer of Stanford University. And in Canada, welcome to Professor Donna Strickland at the University of Waterloo. And here in New Zealand, where we have Professor David Hutchinson of the University of Otago. Now, all three of them work with light, photonics, the science of light generation and the manipulation of matter at the atomic level using light. Dr. Beyer is executive director of the Stanford Photonics Research Center. Professor Strickland is a pioneer in laser physics. She shared the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2018 for her work on developing the most powerful short pulse laser ever created. And Professor Hutchinson is a quantum physicist at the inaugural director of the Dodd-Wall Center for Photonic and Quantum Technologies. It's a multi-university center of research excellence, which has just had an extension of its funding until the end of 2028. Congratulations, David. A bit of background, New Zealand scientists were among the first to recognize the potential of lasers. Dan Walls led a team in the 1970s and 80s at the University of Waikato, and the Dodd-Wall Center was formed in 2015 to pool talent, work on ways to process data in the form of light. So, let me come to you first, Professor Donna Strickland, a self-described laser jock. I said that you'd won the Nobel Prize for your work developing the most powerful short pulse laser ever, as if I knew what I was talking about. Please elaborate on what you did.
Well, I actually didn't have the world's most powerful laser at the time of what I did to get the Nobel Prize. We just showed how you could do it. We had a much smaller laser where I was working. But the idea is that sometimes it's energy that matters, and sometimes it's just how fast that energy comes in. So I like to say that I built a laser hammer, right? Because sometimes if you just push on a nail with your thumb with all your might, it won't go in. You pick up a hammer and wrap it quickly, then it goes in. And so that's what we did, is that we basically took the energy of a fairly high energy laser pulse, but made sure that it was squeezed down into the smallest volume as possible so that we had that energy density. And by doing that, by having a really short pulse and squeezing all those photons down, we could have that hammer. And this is why it's led to things like eye surgery. It comes in and just blasts those electrons right off the atoms.
What's your vision, Tom, of how data could be improved via photonics or via lasers?
Lasers really form the basis for essentially all of the transfer of information from sources to the audience. In fact, almost everything that is going out from this particular interview will be translated into laser pulses and sent on fiber optics. So lasers and fiber optics really are the core of the internet infrastructure, and have the advantage that because of the short pulses, as Donna described, they can transmit large amounts of information very, very quickly. And they can do that over extraordinarily long distances, over oceans and around the world. So this technology has really revolutionized our ability to distribute information around the globe.
So, David, I mean, Jen, particularly with regard to climate change, what do you think we can and should be finding out by means of this technology?
Well, I think the key thing that we're talking about in terms of laser physics, in terms of light, is the fact that you can remotely and consistently interrogate the environment around us. So, for example, we can use laser light to do spectroscopy, to look at what chemicals are in the atmosphere, which is what effectively Donna was talking about in terms of using high-intensity pulses there. So if we really want to know what effect we're having on an environment, be that nitrates in a river or be
But we can measure that now, right?
We can, but what you want is a consistent measure, and you want a measure that is easy. You don't want to have to fly a plane and sample gas from the atmosphere. If you can do it remotely, then you can gain much more information. If we can remotely use spectroscopy to look at nitrate contents on soil, for example, we can assess whether we're using fertilizer effectively. So there are lots of things that we can do using laser light and spectroscopy and various different techniques to tell us about the environment around us. And once we have that information, then we can make informed decisions about what we're doing to either mitigate our production of CO2, we can potentially see what the origin of that CO2 is, or we can look at other pollutants and then regulate around that or decide whether we need to modify our behavior around that. And so it's having reliable information that comes from the fact that we have this ability to sense remotely.
And how speculative are those applications, or is it actually being done now?
I don't think it's speculative at all. I think there are things that are easy, and I think there are things that are hard. And so a lot of what the GEM network is about is not necessarily worrying about the things that are hard to do. It's we should be doing more of the things that we actually already know how to do, and then we should be communicating. Part of the purpose of this is to try and communicate with other people who want to make measurements to say, well, these are things we can already do. Then there are other things that are harder to do, and that's where there's a research side to it, where we want to improve those measurements. But at the moment, I think, from my perspective, a large part of the network is trying to get the right people to talk to each other, and so that we can get to the point where we actually know what's going out up there in that beautiful blue sky with Rayleigh scattering and all that. But
why did you, Donna, get involved in the GEM network in the first place? What was it that was attractive to you?
Well, it really came about the year I was president of the Optical Society, and Tom was a past president at this point of the Optical Society. They brought in something called the National Photonics Initiative in the United States, which I was not part of because that's not my nation. But what it was about was just trying to show society and the public service the importance of photonics in just all kinds of ways in society. And so although I didn't take part in that, I said to Tom, when we're ready to take this international, I want to be part of the international push to show most governments how important photonics is for a host of reasons. And then when it got started on the international level, OSA didn't want to go from government to government to government, you know, to talk about why photonics is important for their particular country's things. And in 2015, just about every nation signed on to the Paris Accord. So it was sort of a natural, oh, okay, well, photonics can help with that. Every nation is trying to do that. Let's show them how important photonics is for that. And so it was sort of much more from my public policy point of view than from my own research point of view that I wanted to get involved.
Right. What about you, Tom? What's your vision? Why did you get involved?
Well, as Donna said, I was involved with the activities at the Optical Society, which is the main scientific society both Donna and I have been involved with. And they've got 25,000 members worldwide, and over half the membership is international. When I was president in 2009, I made climate change one of the main issues that I recruited our membership to be involved with. And we just expanded that to an international effort. And we've had wonderful response from basically all over the globe. And we're establishing centers in basically all the geographic regions. And Dodd Walls is doing a wonderful job of coordinating efforts within the university in Otago.
I read that Australia and Brazil are having difficulty setting up their nodes of GEM. Is this true? Have you broken through on that?
Well, you know, New Zealand, it was a target for us because of your leadership there. New Zealand and Scotland, as it turns out, are two of the regions in the world that are really taking a leadership position with regard to policy and initiatives that recognize the importance of climate change. And there are certain areas of the world where that is not the case. And I happen to live in one of those areas currently. And the idea of being able to work with countries like New Zealand and Scotland and Canada, where there is a enlightened leadership which recognizes that we need to work globally to solve these issues, understand them, and develop effective policies that can help us mitigate and adapt to the climate change that seems to be inevitable. New Zealand is clearly indicating again its leadership position by being involved with the GEM Network as one of the early pioneers.
Measuring things is one thing, developing policy is quite another. And if you don't get countries like your own United States or Brazil or Australia involved, are you still just preaching to the choir in that case?
I think that's very true, but you have to start with the choir and with people who are willing to listen and willing to work, and also recognize the economic opportunities that are there as you go about developing new solutions and technologies. And there is, I think, a majority of the world that recognizes that this is a problem. And I think it provides an opportunity for the leaders there and for the citizens of those countries to take advantage of a leadership position and explore the economic opportunities that are going to present themselves.
When you talk about economic opportunities, you mean in terms of quelling climate change or in terms of making money out of ways to fix it?
Well, you know, I think it's a combination of all of those things. Clearly, there's technology needs that need to be developed. We need to be able to better measure, the global emissions of greenhouse gases and carbon. We need to be able to measure air pollution, measure what's going on in the water resources, which is a particular problem in New Zealand and in other areas of the world, including California. And this requires technology that's cost-effective and accurate and reproducible, internationally accepted as a basis for these measurements. So it starts there, and then it comes down to the economic opportunities that present themselves by better understanding what the impacts are going to be. And then, of course, there's the change that's inevitable to other sources of energy and other ways to power transportation, heat our buildings, and all of the economic potential there. We're looking at different energy sources and different ways to basically live our lives without having to use fossil fuels.
And all this is the promise of photonics, is it?
Well, you know, photonics plays a key role. It has to be engaged with other scientific disciplines. And that's why this is a joint project between the Optical Society and the American Geophysical Union, AGU, which is the leading climatology and earth science society in the world. And it's working in conjunction with these two scientific societies, and then with the other elements that David mentioned and can speak to, which are the policymakers, the private industry that's really going to have to commercialize the technology that we develop, international standards organizations, people who can take the information that we're developing now and the measurements and actually turn them into formats that policymakers can use to make effective policy decisions. And then monitoring those the environment to see exactly what those policy decisions have made in terms of changes to allow us to better understand and adapt and mitigate the impact of climate change. So it takes a village.
And also you're implying that policy change is all right going through the political process, but you can use this technology to examine whether they're actually working.
Absolutely, and we have a great example here in the Bay Area. We've had a shelter-in-place orders from our governor because of the COVID-19 pandemic. We have a wonderful dense network of CO2 and air pollution monitoring technologies, about 100 measurement sites, very precise measurement sites that Ron Cohen at the University of California, Berkeley has installed and has been running for several years. He has been able to measure very accurately the impact of the shelter in place, seeing that we've actually reduced our CO2 load by about 40% over the last 6 months. He's been able to monitor the air pollution reductions that occur because of the shelter-in-place orders and policies that have been put in place. And it's a great example of, we can now feed that back to our policymakers and indicate, hey, this is what you've done, and is it what you intended? And we can then use these as models to this data, as models to predict what will happen as our governor has just said, we basically switch to electrical vehicles for new car sales in 2035. We will know what that impact is going to be and whether what the economic benefits are going to be, what the health benefits are going to be. That's why measurement is so important.
Could you not do that measurement before?
No. The measurements give you a picture of what's going on at a particular point in time and space. But if you want to know why that measurement took place, you've actually got to use weather patterns, wind patterns, in order to be able to understand where that pollution, where that CO2 came from. And that requires mathematical modeling, incorporating weather forecasting, wind patterns. And this is active scientific research that's going on now. Understand how we go from measurements to specifying the emission sources. And then you can determine whether or not effective policy could be put in place to reduce the impact on neighborhoods, on the impact that cities have in the global environment. But even more importantly, if you do it densely enough, you can tell what neighborhoods are being impacted by in a discriminatory basis, a social justice basis, by air pollution. And you can begin to address these things on a neighborhood by neighborhood basis. All of this is technology that really is not in the field. There's only two or three cities in the world that have the capability that exists here in the East Bay.
This panel discussion about the measurement of climate change features a group of international speakers. From Canada, Professor Donna Strickland, a Nobel laureate in physics. From the United States, Dr. Thomas Bayer, executive director of the Stanford Photonics Research Center. And here in Auckland, quantum physicist Professor David Hutchinson from the Dodd Wall Center. This RNZ recording is in association with the Dodd Wall Center at Otago University. And in the chair, I'm Kim Hill. The collecting the data is one thing, but processing it is another. Is that where your quantum computers might come in handy, David?
It's probably a slightly long bow at the moment, but I think at the moment we need to collect sufficient data that we can make decisions on the basis of looking at these things with classical computers. If I was wanting to draw in the quantum side, which is the side where my research is, then obviously I'd say, yes, this is very important. It is one of the things big searches, big analysis of data is an area that quantum computing and quantum information processing may help. But I think in the short term and for this problem around environment, it's much more important just to get reliable data that it is quite possible for us to calculate and understand this on a using classical computers. We've got a small pilot scheme at the moment in Dunedin where we make photonic-based particle pollution sensors, which we distribute to kids through schools so they can go and measure the particular air pollution around their school or take them home. And so this is creating a dense network of sensors in Dunedin, which we then are working with a company, Animation Research Limited, which many people will be familiar with. They do all the graphics for golf, for the fly-throughs for the golf courses and tracking the balls and things like that. They've done some nice visualization software, so we can actually take the data and then we can show the areas of Dunedin that have worse particulate air pollution and areas that have better. We have a very hilly city, as you know, and there are, in the winter there are areas where you have temperature inversions and pollution gets trapped, and so there are significant health outcomes, negative health outcomes associated with that pollution. And so it, at the moment, it's not monitored and it's not mapped. And so this is something we can start doing based on technology that we have, sensors that have been developed here in this building, actually, by Southern Photonics, and we can distribute that relatively cheaply and get kids to actually really understand what they're is happening in their environment, and then lobby the Otago Regional Council to make changes, or the Education Ministry. Half of our schools still burn solid fuel. You know, like that's affecting, potentially affecting the health of our kids.
It's so interesting, isn't it? It's like personalizing the information so that the people who are in a position to do something about it can't say somebody else's problem.
Absolutely.
Donna, what got you involved in lasers in the first place?
My mother tells the story that when I was 10, the Ontario Science Centre was brand new in Toronto, and my parents took the three kids. And it's surprising that in 1969, the Ontario Science Museum already had a CO2 laser there, because in 69, they really weren't out of the research labs much, right? And my dad, who was an electrical engineer, supposedly said to us kids, we have to see this. This is the way of the future. Now, I don't really remember that, but my mom says, anytime I would talk about it, mom would tell you that was why I have a love of lasers. You know, I was looking around for what I wanted to do as an undergrad, and a nearby university had a program in lasers and electro-optics. And I just read it and went, that just sounds so much fun. Like, who wouldn't want to study that? And partly, I guess, because you didn't see them all the time. It was sort of this new thing, and it was in the 70s, and it just sounded too cool.
I asked you earlier about that picture behind you that we can see on the Zoom screen. Can you tell me that, please?
So my husband's grandfather was an artist. He had a studio in the Smithsonian, and AT&T Bell Labs back in a long time ago, I guess the 30s, commissioned a marble of Alexander Graham Bell. And the story that goes along with this, so this is just a picture of the marble.
Yeah.
When it was done, it's in the newspapers that his family was very upset, saying he just looks like a grumpy old man. And Alexander replied, I am a grumpy old man. Now, supposedly he was kind of grumpy because he always thought he could better himself than just the telephone, because he did the telephone fairly early and always thought he could top it, right? So I like to have it behind me now when I'm doing all these Zoom things, just to keep reminding me.
What about you, Tom? Why photonics?
Well, you know, when I was in college, I decided I was quite an activist and decided if I was going to go in and do science, which has been my interest since I was very young, that I really wanted to choose an area where I thought that there would be a societal applications and something, a technology that not only had a good science application, but also was something that would have an impact. And so I chose to focus on laser technology because I felt that that was a good combination of where I could do good science and yet also contribute in an activist way towards solving societal problems.
How did you draw that conclusion that getting involved in laser science and photonics would help, you know, save the world?
Well, again, back in the early 70s when I was making these decisions, it was clear that lasers were beginning to be applied in medicine. It was prior to fiber optics for the most part and telecommunications, but lasers were moving into supermarkets as supermarket scanners and going into CD players. It was pretty clear that the technology was making this transition from a laboratory curiosity to a commercial impact. And there was opportunity there. And I felt I was also interested in being involved with industrial research, which is where I took my career after I got my PhD, and looking at different laser applications as well. The other side of this is I am partially colorblind, and this could be a compensatory mechanism for just being able to finally see some bright colors in regions of the spectrum where I'm not very sensitive. So that's another reason why lasers appeal to me.
I mean, you've done a number of startup companies from Silicon Valley. I can understand exciting on one level because, I mean, personal enrichment, nothing wrong with that. But how did you make the extension to they could do good for the world? I mean, supermarket checkouts is not the sign of a sainthood on the way.
No, it's a good question. And, you know, it's basically not only lasers, but how lasers get applied. And it's very similar to what you asked earlier about what is photonics in climate science? Well, lasers and photonics play a big role in medicine. And that's where I took my career in lasers, was looking at how we could develop biomedical instrumentation, which could help diagnose cancer, could diagnose HIV and AIDS, could help in reproductive services, neuroscience. And that's really where I took my skills, is not just studying lasers and photonics, but seeing where they could be applied to really help people. And that's a large part of my career, was involved with developing technology along those lines of biomedical applications. So lasers and photonics by themselves are not the answer. It's combining it with other other technologies and other areas of science, which can provide a great impact and great societal impact.
Yeah. Let's talk about the money-making aspect of it for a moment, David, because, you know, all this climate change data collection, that's a very good idea, but can New Zealand make money out of our investment in the Dodd Wall Centre?
Absolutely.
He made me ask that question.
The Dodd Wall Centre is very broad, and so there are elements that are quite applied. There are elements that are more fundamental physics,
which is presumably the way you think it should be.
Absolutely, it's on the applied side. We have a huge agrarian economy in New Zealand, and so one of the areas we focused on in terms of our photonics applications are applications of photonics for agriculture, and so one of the best proponents of that is here in the audience, Keith Simpson, who I think had great foresight and went out to the dairy industry and asked what their problems were and found ways that she could apply laser physics to solving those problems. One of those problems being how do you select sperm in artificial insemination so that you avoid having bobby calves? You know, obviously that's a problem that you can solve with laser physics. You know, but it turns out you can, and she's got a very successful company now that actually selects sperm on the basis of fluorescence, shoves the sperm around with the little laser beams into channels, and selects just the female sperm so that you won't have any more bobby calves. And that makes a huge difference then to the dairy industry. It increases the efficiency of our industry. It increases the profitability of that industry, which increases the profitability of New Zealand Inc. So that's just one example of how you can take laser technology and actually change what we do in New Zealand to make the whole country more profitable. Of course, in the process of doing that, she's generated another company, which then, in its own right, will make money. And so then you're developing a high-tech sector. And the thing I'm most passionate about through our center, we're funded actually by from Vote Education, not from Vote Research, Science and Technology. And it's developing then pathways for our graduate students to go through. And so they can have a meaningful, fulfilling career in New Zealand in a high-tech industry, developing these sorts of things, not have to go overseas. We retain those people. And so then we have a higher skilled workforce, and we end up with more people making more money with the ability to make more investment. And we diversify our economy away from being so reliant on that agrarian sector or tourism, which has just been decimated.
So I
think it's absolutely essential for New Zealand's economy. And even if you just take, for example, recently with the Australian New Zealand Optical Society and the Dodd Wall Centre, we jointly commissioned, supported by SPIE, which is another optics organisation, to do a study of the economic impact of photonics in Australia and New Zealand. And from that study, we identified that photonics is already worth about $1.2 billion in the New Zealand economy. A lot of that is the communications aspect that Tom was talking about earlier, but a lot of it too is around, for example, small amounts of Fisher & Paykel Healthcare in their product testing and their product development involves photonics. And so a small amount of their business, which is a very large business, can be apportioned to the impact of photonics. And so it's a service element to our economy already, and more importantly, it's a rapidly growing element of our economy. So the bottom line, I think, was yes.
All right. Tom, you're in a better position than most to talk about the need for a kind of a critical mass of science research development going on, you know, Silicon Valley. Do you think that we could achieve that in New Zealand?
Oh, I think so. It takes government help and incentives to provide the sort of network to allow risk taking. One of the advantages of Silicon Valley is its size. And there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of companies that are being generated each year within 50-mile radius. So if I join a startup, it's fairly easy, even if the startup fails, for me to find another opportunity. One of the challenges facing New Zealand is you don't have that critical mass, as you put it. And it's important that the government recognize the risk-taking that's involved with starting a new enterprise and provide that a comparable level of security for those people who are embarked on these more risky enterprises. Not too much security, because you do want them to try their hardest to be successful. But nonetheless, programs like the Small Business Innovative Research, SBIR program here in the US, are very, very important in those portions of the country that don't have the large venture capital nucleus that we have here in Silicon Valley.
When I hear these things and, you know, can New Zealand do it? Can I always bring up the example that I love is Korea. My parents went and spent 3 months in Korea in 1991. And, you know, they came home and talked to me about it. And the first time I went to Korea was 2011. So it was 20 years. And I can tell you the Korea that I saw was not at all the Korea that my parents saw in 1991. Mm-hmm. And I mean, after they were finished with their disastrous war, I think they looked around and saw we're a mountainous country. We don't have the resources. I have to tell you, Canada, you know, lives with 0.5% of the world's population and 15% of the resources. So we aren't as driven as other countries. That's maybe our biggest problem, to be innovative. But Korea went, you know what? What are we going to do? And they put their eggs in the science basket. They built a science city. They put together their government researchers. They brought in companies to be there, and they built a university to be there so that government, industry, and academia would all work together, starting with a very small science output. And before you know it, I mean, in 2011, I then go to another country and see three billboards in a row: Samsung, LG, and Hyundai. And I went, isn't that amazing that somehow Korea went from a poor country to this country that has three huge global companies? So I really am a big proponent that governments should be seriously thinking about, if they want to do something for their economy, science is a good bet. But it has to be fostered, and it has to be fostered in a wonderful way. Also, if you go to, and I think this is what your center is also going to see in New Zealand, it sounds like they've brought all three parts together. But again, Korean universities, you will see Samsung buildings, you will see LG buildings, you will see Hyundai buildings. They really believe that they all have to work together, because you have to start with the purest research to get to those final new products, right? If we don't keep feeding from the bottom, we can't keep coming up with new and new products without more and more information always bringing in. So this is one of the reasons that I am sort of a public policy person and trying to always bring to the forefront the importance of science to the government and society, right? And when we can talk about the importance of photonics, just for global measurements, we've been talking about spectroscopy and things, but the beautiful thing about lasers is they're everywhere, right? So one of the things that we're doing in Canada is that, again, an economic impact, it depends on how you look at it, but we have the Arctic. And a big part of Canada is the Arctic. And they can only come in and bring supplies to our Arctic by airplanes for about half the year, right? The other half of the year, they have the ice roads and trucks can come in. But the permafrost is now melting and the airstrips are on the permafrost. And so we now have photonic sensors in that permafrost runways just to see the changes that climate change is having and causing havoc to the people. So that's a real economic struggle that they're going to have if we can't get supplies to them in the next few years. So I don't know, I just think photonics is everywhere and it's important from an economic point of view in all kinds of strata.
You're listening to RNZ and a panel discussion about the measurement of climate change with me, Kim Hill. Professor Donna Strickland, a Nobel laureate in physics, joins us from Canada. And from the United States, Dr. Thomas Bayer, Executive Director of the Stanford Photonics Research Center. Here in Auckland is quantum physicist Professor David Hutchinson, Director of the Dodwall Center. It's possible, I don't know what you think about this, David, that New Zealand suffers from what's become known as the resource curse, in that, you know, the land of milk and meat. And we really have not got ourselves away from that concept of ourselves. as I mean, Korea probably didn't have many options.
We're very capable of change and adaptable in New Zealand as well, though. There's plenty of opportunity and plenty of examples in history of where there've been radical change. If you go back to when we exported wool, and then with the SS Dunedin, which was the first refrigerated ship, sailed from Dunedin to London, transporting frozen lamb, that really transformed the New Zealand economy overnight. And so we went from a backwater to somewhere that had one of the highest GDPs per head of population in the world, based on that single change, which was based on, if you think about it, it's only 50 years earlier that Kelvin was writing his treatises on thermodynamics, and it was all designed for steam engines, but it was the same technology that led to the refrigeration on the ship. And we had to have engineers here in New Zealand who could understand and build that, and then take up that technology to change the world. What we're talking about here is, I come back to the idea that we're training people, and as long as you train bright people and give them opportunity, they will see the niches and the areas that New Zealand can contribute in, and we'll grasp that, and it'll generate industries. They may not be the multi-billion dollar industries, but we don't necessarily need them. If we just had a couple of Fisher and Paykel healthcares extra, you know, like, the beauty of being in a small country is you don't need a huge amount to change where we're making our money. And we're not going to see agriculture go away. No one's talking about getting rid of that backbone of our economy. The things we're talking about are, how do we make it more efficient, and how do we build service industry and technology on top of that, which we can then sell to the world as another aspect of our technology and our export business. So I'm very optimistic about where we are. I think we've got great people. We've got great investment in our center through to 2028, and I think the onus on us now is to take up that mantle. We've got, that's nearly a decade of basically the direction for atomic molecular and optical physics in New Zealand, and if we can't do something with that, then you probably shouldn't fund us the next time.
Okay. He's putting his cards on the table. I am aware that the audience that we have in Auckland and in Dunedin are far better informed than I about many aspects of this question. So let us take some questions, please.
I would like to know what success looks like for the GEM Network. When do you pop open a bottle of champagne and say, hey, look what we did?
That's a good question. Who would you like to hear from? Let's go to David.
Oh, I was hoping you'd go to Tom, to be honest.
I know, but I saw that shifty look on your face. I thought, no.
When people start quoting you back, well, one of the great successes we had here was when the Foundation for Research, Science and Technology, as was, when their literature came out for new funding rounds and they started talking about photonics, that was when we knew we'd had success. So that we'd actually managed to get them to listen to what we were saying, and they realized that this was an important segment of the science sector and an area that New Zealand had some influence in. So I think once you start getting politicians and policymakers to start giving your same words back, then you know that they're starting to listen to you. So that to me would be a moment to pop open the champagne. But Tom's probably got a better view than I have on that.
Tom?
Well, just some examples of what I think are successful programs that are ongoing right now. COP26, which is the Conference of Parties, is a UN-sponsored meeting where the protocols get set up for greenhouse gas emission reductions. It's going to be held in Glasgow, Scotland. Well, we happen to have a GEM Center in Glasgow, Scotland, and we've been working very closely with the city of Glasgow now, implementing the same sort of dense network that I mentioned in the Bay Area. That technology is being transferred over to the city of Glasgow. We're right in the process now of installing 30 sensors in the city, and they're going to be monitoring both greenhouse gas emission as well as pollution monitoring, and feeding that back in terms of information to the city council. So every week I now have a meeting with the city of Glasgow officials discussing that installation process and what they're going to learn from that that network. We are planning a preview event for the COP26, which has now been rescheduled because of the COVID-19 situation, to November of 2021. We're going to have a preview event November 10th involving officials from the state of California, officials from the government of Scotland, representatives from the UK, and actually from Canada and elsewhere, in an international webinar discussing the importance of being able to measure CO2 and greenhouse gas emission from cities. And we've invited mayors and city officials from all over the world to be a part of this, the audience here, and to work with us to establish comparable networks in cities around the globe. So as we begin to see this idea that measurement is necessary in order for us to be able to manage these elements of climate change and air pollution and other aspects of human impact on the environment, we're beginning to see this global effort really take shape. So it's these individual wins, both regional and regional cooperation between the GEM centers, that I view as distinct measures of success.
Thank you for that. Can I just ask you, Tom, this is a kind of a philosophical and ethical issue. Has there ever been a conflict for you between being an activist and being a scientist?
As an activist, my role is to provide the information necessary so that we can allow our policymakers to make evidence-based decisions. So it's not really, and it's not the role of scientists to set policy.
But it is the role of scientists to decide what they're going to measure.
Yes, it is. And I think that needs to be done on a neutral basis. So we do need to make sure that what we're doing is covering the bases necessary so that we can supply the information so that there can be effective decision-making that's based on evidence. And so my activism is really neutral in that sense, that I don't have a particular political agenda. What I'm trying to do is make sure I understand what the needs are of policymakers and that we direct our science to developing the technology necessary to supply that information in a useful basis. So that's my activism. It's not really of any particular political orientation. And again, it's not our role to set policy or even recommend policy. It's to provide the information necessary so that policymakers can make evidence-based decisions.
So can I pick up on that? I think there's a real role for centers of informal learning in this. And it's one of the things that I'm very proud of within the Dodd Wall Center. We've partnered very well with museums here in Auckland, in Otago, and wider around the country. And I think getting our science and information about science into centers of informal learning, you reach so many more kids. And if you can actually spark that interest in science in just a few of those kids, then we have a real impact there, perhaps greater than the economic impact that we have through some of the technology we develop.
One of the great things that I've gotten to do in the last year was Brian May of Queen, famous rock star. You know, he also has a PhD in physics, and he runs an event that brings together the Apollo astronauts, musicians, Nobel Prize winning scientists, and we all get together and sort of put on a show almost. And it brings people in that aren't necessarily science oriented, right? When I just go out and give a talk, I pretty much know that the audience I'm speaking to maybe aren't scientists, but they already love science. And it would be great if we can find more ways to work with entertainment and arts to bring it out to the wider audience.
This is a completely naive observation, but it seems to me that back in the day, everybody was a scientist and science was a whole new, 17th century, 18th century, 19th century, science was a great playground and very interdisciplinary. Everybody had a contribution. Then it became siloed, but it seems now that it's becoming much more interdisciplinary again.
The problem was that we became siloed because as we learned more and more and more and more and more, there's only so much any one of our brains can handle at one time. And so now we are trying to get these centers so that we can have multiple people working together to bring it all together.
So, yeah, and let me add to that as well. You know, what I tell my students when they're looking for career direction is that working in the liminal spaces, the spaces between disciplines, is a very viable way to go because it brings a certain element of uniqueness to their career. So I encourage them to go multidisciplinary. It's not only bringing people from the different disciplines together. A true multidisciplinary team is a team of multidisciplinarians. It's people who have multiple skill sets and who can talk in the language of these different disciplines to encourage communication between the leaders in the field in these different areas. So, you know, I think at this point, if you're really looking for the greatest impact, it is through multidisciplinary focus in many areas of science.
The idea of this bringing economic prosperity as well as ameliorating climate change may seem to some people as a contradiction in terms, because economic prosperity and growth is exactly what's led us to this impasse. You don't see going forward that there is a contradiction between those two things?
I absolutely see it's not a simple problem and with a simple solution. And taking into account the impacts. In New Zealand's the impact on the dairy industry, if you're trying to solve the nitrate pollution problem. What is that impact? But there may be simple solutions where if you monitor the nitrate levels, there may be times at which you simply got to be careful about where your cows are wandering around in the pasture. And that may help the cows and it may help dairy production. And what we need to do is understand the problem and have our policymakers, and this is where it goes beyond just science. The policymakers have got to understand the impacts on various elements of society and provide the sort of structures necessary to allow to compensate that. We can't just put a bunch of coal miners and fossil fuel miners out of work. We've got to figure out how we're going to transition them to more constructive uses of their skills and talents. So it's not I don't think it's a simple problem. I don't want to imply that. I think it requires good leadership and it requires these leaders to balance these different forces that are there. I'm Irish, I'm inherently an optimist. And I feel that there is tremendous economic potential, even if we are balancing these different elements of society and providing equity to those people that are going to be negatively impacted. And we've got to recognize that. We've got to have our policymakers able to address that. And then we can move forward. But ultimately, I think there's just opportunity ahead of us.
Like I live in a small city in New Zealand, Dunedin, which you visited, Tom. And all of the headlines in our local newspaper, the Otago Daily Times, over the last few years have been job losses and closures. We've closed the railway workshops, the heavy industry there, Hillside Road. We've closed our Cadbury factory, which was one of the sort of early manufacturing bases there. But what's not told in the newspaper is that we've had quarter-on-quarter job growth throughout that entire period of time. So while we've been laying off those people in heavy industry, Fisher & Paykel Appliances, which make washers and dryers and things like that, they closed their manufacturing in Dunedin. But all the time we've had small high-tech companies growing in Dunedin, and so they've more than compensated for the number of jobs that have been lost in the heavy industry, and they're better paid jobs as well. And yes, there are people who are lower skilled workers who have lost their jobs through that, but then there are people who come into those higher paid jobs and there are more restaurants, there are more cafes, there's more service industry around that which has provided other jobs as well. So in microcosm, I think Dunedin over the last 5 or 6 years is probably, well, at least pre-COVID, been the most vibrant that I've ever seen it. And I think what we're seeing there is an example of what we're talking about, is that we can replace some of the things that are maybe labor or product or resource intensive with things that are more knowledge based, more where the value add is through intelligence and through design, and we can see prosperity that way, where we still grow our economy, but while we reduce our footprint on the planet. So I like you, Tom, I'm an optimist on this. I think that there's huge opportunity, especially here, for us to do some of these things.
Are you really optimistic, or are you just pretending to be optimistic? Well, you know, you have to, don't you, right? I mean, there's no point in you sitting here saying, oh, God, what's the point?
But it doesn't matter. The world keeps changing all the time. The shipbuilders had to quit building ships when the airplanes came along. And I mean, the shipbuilders could have complained and complained and complained to the policymakers, but that wasn't going to stop people from going, you know, a few hours across the ocean instead of a few days. And so it doesn't matter. We're going to keep moving. And so, you know, and those of us in photonics will tell you, it is where electronics was there in the 20th century. It is photonics with the 21st century. It's, you know, we're moving with the speed of light. And, you know, I think you have to be broad-based. I don't think everybody should do photonics, but I don't think you can just keep saying, this is the way it's always been. Therefore, it has to always be that way, because it's a global society and people are just going to do what they're going to do.
You don't get people to change by predicting catastrophe or Armageddon.
No,
you get
of course.
People to change by showing the opportunity. And so I think one of the problems with scientists today in the climate area is they just predict catastrophe. We have got to show people the opportunity or else they're not going to change. You know, if you talk to anybody in the States and you mention Scotland, they think whiskey. If you mention New Zealand, you think rugby. And, you know, that's got to change. It's got to be, we want people to think of these countries as being leaders in the whole change that needs to take place to deal with the climate situation. And these countries, as small as they are, they can be, they can take the lead on this. And I think that really is what needs to happen. And you need to do that with a positive perspective on what's going to happen as we go about these changes and deal with the real challenges that face us.
I'd like to thank my guests, Professor Donna Strickland, Dr. Tom Bayer, and Professor David Hutchinson, for this edition of Smart Talk about measuring climate change. In the chair for this recording, made in partnership with the Dolt Walls Centre at Otago University, I'm Kim Hill for RNZ.